It took a long time for the human race to reach a billion people. It took a lot less time to add the second billion and so on. Now we're adding about a billion people to the Earth every 13 years or so. Currently, we're somewhere north of 7 billion in population. It looks like our capacity to make more people is endless. But a growing number of experts say it's more likely that we'll get to about 9 billion people in the middle of the century, then begin to go backwards. Human population will start dropping. That case gets support from the authors of the book Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. It's the work of Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson. Daryl Bricker is the chief executive at Ipsos Public Affairs. When you hear about AP Ipsos polls, it's that Ipsos. John Ibbotson is a writer at large for the Globe and Mail out of Toronto, Canada's biggest national newspaper. They joined forces previously on a study of Canadian politics called The Big Shift. John Ibbotson is our guest. Welcome to The Exchange.
Hello.
It's a fascinating field, I noticed, just by looking at fertility rates and how they've trended over the past 60 years or so. This really can be an all-consuming sort of study, can't it?
Well, it's sort of consumed us for the last 3 years outside our day jobs. Yeah, I mean, there's a kind of knowledge that's called vertical knowledge. That's knowledge that everybody knows, from the president to senior advisors to university professors to business leaders to students to the person out on the street. And it's universally shared knowledge. And that knowledge in terms of population is that we are going to get to about 11.2 billion people by the end of the century. That's what the United Nations Population Division projects. Their projections have always been pretty dead on in the past. And so we assume that they're right. We're going to go from more than 7 billion now to 11 billion at the end of the century. It's going to be painful. It's going to hurt the environment. It's going to be a huge issue in the fight against global warming and all sorts of other forms of environmental degradation. It will destabilize the planet politically because you're going to have 4 more billion people that have to be fed and housed and looked after, many of whom might end up being on the move. So it's pretty much universally a bad thing. But there is a growing body of demographers based in Europe who say the United Nations projections are wrong, that there are new factors at work that are causing an acceleration in decline in birth rates. The UN isn't taking that data into account. And because it's not taking that data into account, it fails to recognize that we're not going to get much above 9 billion by the middle of the century, and then start to do something the human race has never done in all of its history. We will begin a slow, prolonged, deliberately imposed decline in our population. And once that starts, it is likely never to stop.
You're not being really polite about the UN view here either, because you don't just say that they're mildly wrong. You say they're completely, utterly wrong. I mean, so what are some of the additional bits of information that you use that the UN apparently doesn't?
There is, it can be summed up in a single word, and the word is urbanization. Now, the UN itself points to the fact that in 2007, for the first time in a human history, we became more urban than rural. Most human beings live in cities now. Today, it's actually 55%. And that just continues to grow every year. Something happens when you move from the countryside to the city. The first thing is a child stops being an asset and becomes a liability. It stops being just another pair of hands to work in the field. It starts to become just another mouth to feed. A second thing that happens when you move from countryside to city, and this was true historically of developed countries and is true today of developing countries, and that is women acquire education. They have access to schools that they didn't have when they were living in the village. They have access to media that they didn't have before. They have access to other women that they didn't have when they were in isolated environments. When women acquire education, invariably they begin to make demands, the right that to have control over their own bodies is the most fundamental demand that they make of all. And when women do start to have some control over their own bodies, over their reproductive choices, when they get to choose, invariably around the world, without exception, no matter what culture you're in, no matter what economic state you're in, they choose to have fewer children. This is a universal. There are also impacts, religious influence declines once you leave the countryside and move to the city. The power of clans extended families declines once you leave the countryside and move into the city. And all these factors combine to start to bring down fertility rates. They did it in the developed world over about 150 years, so that by the in today, there is not a single country in the developed world that is producing 2.1 children who are needed on average in order to keep a population stable.
That's going to say the replacement world, rate, 2.1 children per woman?
Exactly so. If you if your society produces 2.1 children per woman, your population is stable. More, your population grows. Fewer, your population eventually starts to go down. The developed world took a century and a half to get below 2.1. It's happening in the developing world in a single generation.
So I can imagine some people thinking, whew, that's good. We take some of the pressure off the planet. We can get seats easier at Giants games, that sort of thing. But some of the drawbacks of a shrinking population have been brought up before, for example, paying into Social Security. Can you give us a short list as we come up to a break in about a minute?
In about a minute, for the environment, nothing but good. It's great in the fight against global warming because you're going to have fewer people on the earth, and also because once you urbanize, then marginal farmland goes back to bush, which is a terrific carbon sink and also improves biodiversity. We could talk about it after the break more, but economically, the numbers are nothing but bad. As you alluded to, fewer young people to pay the pensions and health care of many older people, and fewer people available to consume. It is consumption that drives an economy. And geopolitically, a very mixed bag and very much to the United States' advantage if the United States does the right things.
Ooh, let's talk about what the right thing is. You really know how to set a hook for a second segment. John Ibbotson is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's from the Globe and Mail in Toronto, and he's talking to us about the book he wrote with Daryl Bricker called Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. You can join the conversation on the Exchange by phone and email. We'll be right back to it in a minute 25 here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We're talking about the world's population and where it is heading. There is one set of demographers that says it'll keep getting up to about 11 billion by the end of this century. Another set that says, no, it'll top off at 9 billion plus or minus at about the middle of the century and then begin to decline. So for the first time in human history, we're talking about the potential for shrinkage in the actual number of people on the planet. We are talking to John Ibbotson about his book on this, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. He and Daryl Bricker, the co-authors. You can join us at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. You were just talking, John, about how in the developed world, nobody's really running at replacement rate, 2.1 births per woman, which is considered what you need to maintain your population in a static state. We're all under that. So if the birth rate drops where you live, you can bring in new people. And there's an example where you're sitting right now in Canada. What did Canada do in this respect?
Well, Canada's always had a hard time competing with the United States for immigrants. I was listening to you talking about the temperatures at the top of the hour. Boy, I'd kill for those temperatures in Ottawa in the early parts of January, or early parts of February. So it was always a big issue for us trying to bring immigrants into Canada. And it meant that we had a slightly different attitude than the Americans did. We went out and recruited immigrants. Back in the 1890s, the government said, we've got to send agents out into Eastern Europe, Ukraine, Poland, Hungary, Eastern Germany, places like that. And we've got to convince them to come to Canada. And we did, and we've been doing it ever since. So we have a different idea about immigration, slightly than you do. For example, today we bring in more immigrants on a per capita basis than any country in the world. If you were bringing in immigrants at Canada's rate, you'd be bringing in more than 3 million people a year. You bring in 1 million people a year. We mix that with a Canadian version of multiculturalism that's a bit different from the American one. which is more inclined here to say there are values that you have to ascribe to, there are rules that you have to follow, but you're pretty welcome when you come to Canada to continue to embrace your own host culture. You know, the kids always disappear anyway into the Canadian version of the melting pot. But multiculturalism, as we call it, is also a policy here. This has made Canada really well positioned in a world that is going to be growing smaller to bring in people to replace our population, to sustain ourselves. We should be up around 50 million by the middle of the century. But you should be up around 450 million and climbing by the middle of the century, because the United States also has a robust immigration policy historically. The great question is you going to continue that immigration policy, which would seriously advantage you over China and Russia, or are you going to abandon it and lose what could be the biggest competitive advantage the United States has got in the 21st century?
Well, this was the hook you set just before the break. You said on a geopolitical basis, it all favors the United States if we take advantage of it. How would we take advantage of it? What advantage would it confer?
Just do what you're doing right now and don't stop. That's all you have to do. China has a fertility rate of 1.5. They are half a baby short of what they need in order to sustain their population. Now, they've lifted the one-child policy that only allowed parents to have one kid. And they hope that's going to produce an increase in birth rates, but it never does anywhere in the world, again, developed or developing. Once you get below 2.1, you stay there. People just get used to it. It becomes natural to have one or two kids or maybe just get a dog. Large families become the exception rather than the norm. So the Chinese are going to stay at a fertility rate of 1.5 going forward. They are going to start losing people in just a few years. Just a few years. The UN's very conservative numbers predict that China will lose 300 million people in the course of this century. They will go from 1.3 billion people to 1 billion people. There are demographers in China who believe the numbers are going to be much more serious than that, that China could lose 400 or 500 million people over the course of the century. If that's the case, then the population gap between the United States and China would seriously narrow. China also would have the huge problems of trying to deal with a very old society, very few young people, because they don't bring in immigrants, and very few resources to sustain all those old people, and a very restless younger generation wondering why they have to work so hard and pay so many taxes to prop up the elderly. So if the United States just continues a reasonably open-door policy, if that's what we can describe your policies right now, and continue to bring in immigrants to replace what would otherwise be American population decline, because you're below what 2.1 as well, you would be losing population soon without immigrants, then it is a huge advantage. And Russia's a basket case. So you might as well take advantage of it, provided you don't listen to the certain voices in the United States that want to close the doors.
John Ibbotson, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, the co-author with Daryl Bricker of the book Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. We have a call on the line from Anne in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange.
Thank you. So have you ever been in a coffee shop or a restaurant and you see four young people all sitting around at that table? Each one of them is looking at their iPhone. None of them is interacting with the other person. This is the other factor that I think you should consider in your population statistics. Young people aren't learning to interact with each other. Plus, given all the varieties of pornography that one can find on the Internet, aren't some people going to choose that route rather than the messiness of actually interacting with another human being? Let me know what you think.
All right. Thanks for the questions, Anne. Appreciate that. John?
It's not a direction we go in. We are talking about the population of the planet of the Earth. And there are many different kinds of people. The people in the Philippines and the people in Kenya, people in Brazil and the people in Oregon lead very different lives. Demographically, they have a huge amount in common, which is to say, once they get educated and once women have power, once the power of religion declines, once the power of clan declines, fertility rates decline and decline quickly. The social interactions of young people isn't something we look at. I'll tell you one thing we do look at, though. We look at teenage pregnancies. Do you know that in the United States since the 1970s, your teenage pregnancy rate has declined by 2/3? In Canada, by the way, the decline, our decline has been 80%. We have eliminated 80% of teenage pregnancies over the last 40 years. You have eliminated 2/3 of them. That is entirely the result of not watching pornography or lacking learning to interact. It is entirely the result of good sex education and the availability of contraception. It is a wonderful thing in this world to have many fewer teenage pregnancies. I think that is something that the Americans and Canadians can both celebrate, but it is also a major contributor to a decline in global fertility.
So take us back in time. There's a good history lesson in here. Humans almost didn't make it, as you point out. What was the big event of 70,000 years ago?
It was the eruption of Mount Toba. Now, this, like so many other things, is controversial. Some believe it and others don't. The evidentiary base is still unsettled. But it looks as though there was a massive eruption about 70,000 years ago. We were already in an ice age. And so the ash that blanketed the Earth, further cooling temperatures, was a huge crisis for us and brought us down possibly to some tens of thousands of people. There were only tens of thousands, maybe about 75,000 Homo sapiens left on Earth, sort of clinging to the shores of southern Africa and trying to get by. And, you know, one more bit of bad news in them, that might have been it for us. But luckily the skies cleared and we began our great trek. And from that point until this, we have grown in population, notwithstanding, you know, occasional plagues and famines and other catastrophes. We have grown in population from then to now. What Daryl Bricker and I find so fascinating about this topic is that for the first time in human history, because of choices being made today, right now, each and one of us ourselves, in the lives that we choose and the number of children we choose to have, we are going to start to deliberately become fewer every year. And once it starts, it cannot stop, because every year there are fewer 20-somethings than 30-somethings, which means every year the available pool of women to have kids goes down. And barring some massive decision to let's all go out and have, you know, six babies, that will never change.
John Ibbotson, again, our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a journalist, a writer at large for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. He and Daryl Bricker from Ipsos Public Affairs joined forces for a book called Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. The thesis being, as other demographers talk about, that the Earth's population will hit about 9 billion about the middle of the century and then begin a decline, a decline deliberate, not based on some calamity or plague, as has happened in the past. You can join the conversation on the Exchange as we talk about the ramifications of Earth's population beginning to shrink deliberately for the first time. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. You point out in the history lesson that there were setbacks. I mean, we did get to around $400 million people, and then plague, and a couple times that we got bigger and then got smaller again. Nature and human behavior, war, obviously kept up quite a turnover. So do you talk about stage one societies transitioning to stage two? So how does a society graduate from that stage one to stage two?
So in a stage one society, which was most of our history, you'd have a lot of births and a lot of deaths. And the number of births barely gets above the number of deaths. And that's just what primitive society was like. In stage two, you start to bring down the death rate. You've discovered sanitation, perhaps, or hygiene. You've improved your food crops. From Europe, the discovery of North America was a massive improvement in calorie intake. So you started to take down your population, your death rate, but your birth rate is still high. Population starts to grow. And this is where we were at around 1800, when Thomas Malthus wrote his famous treatise saying, we're doomed to keep producing more and more babies than we are able to sustain with the food available. This is going to lead to tremendous crashes and starvation and, you know, an unpleasant oscillation over history, and nothing can stop it. But Malthus, of course, was wrong. We went from 1 billion to 2 billion, from 2 billion now to 7 billion. And, of course, our life expectancies have vastly increased from the days of Malthus. We've just gotten very good at feeding people. And, you know, the technology of the Green Revolution makes it comfortably easy for us to feed 7 billion. There hasn't been, in 20 years, a famine on this earth other than one that was imposed on people by either, you know, war or corrupt governments. So the Malthusians have always been wrong. Paul Ehrlich's population bomb in the 1960s, which predicted the collapse in the 1980s, that was wrong. The Club of Rome's predictions in the 1970s, the collapse would come in the early 2000s, they're wrong. There are books out there today, there are movies. You can't turn on Netflix without, you know, the Earth so despoiled that we're flying off to the moons of Jupiter. That's all linked to the notion of overpopulation. All of it is wrong.
Well, about Malthus and Paul Ehrlich, it's been said that perhaps they were right in effect, but wrong on timing. Is that possible, do you think?
Well, Malthus is going on 250 years out, so that's pretty wrong on timing. That's what Paul Ehrlich says, though. He says, you know, he might have got the decade wrong, but it's going to happen you know, later rather than sooner. But again, you know, we've proved that we are able to sustain ourselves at these numbers. We might even be able to sustain ourselves at 11 billion. Again, we've always been able to prove the doomsayers wrong. But what Daryl and I are saying is one factor that's not being considered is we're not going to just keep on growing and growing and growing. We're going to start declining in population, and that's going to have a huge impact on these Malthusian predictions.
The numbers, again, just fascinate me, and in addition to all the stories behind the numbers, and just as an example of a society going from stage one to stage two, England and Wales, 6 million people roughly in 1750, by 1900, 33 million, more than five times as much. Is that fairly typical growth for a society making this step into stage two?
Yes, but here's the fascinating thing. The stage, it's not the importance of the stages, it's the speed with which you go from one stage to another. Let's go back to the United States, for example. In 1800, a white American woman, there was no data, unfortunately, on African-American or Native American women, but a white American woman in 1800 would have seven children. A woman in 1900 would have four children. So the United States halved its birth rate, almost halved its birth rate in the course of the 19th century. Of course you did. You were industrializing. You were urbanizing. All the things that I talked about earlier were starting to happen. By the time of the Second World War, the fertility rate in the United States wasn't that far above replacement rate. And then you had the big baby boom after the Second World War, which kind of hid it, made everybody think, oh, we're having babies like crazy. But it was just a blip. It was just 20 years. And then it started to go back down again. So that by the 1970s, the United States, along with other developed countries, was reaching the replacement stage, for stage four, where you have a birth rate that's just enough to keep the population stable, but you also have a long-lived population. And then it kept going to what is now called stage five, where the birth rate is below replacement rate. That took the United States about 150 years. It's taking countries like Brazil a generation. They are urbanizing at an incredible speed, and as they urbanize at an incredible speed, their fertility rates are falling at an incredible speed. So as I said, China is 1.5, half a baby below. Brazil, 1.8. Brazil has the fifth largest population on Earth. They are going to start losing people. The amazing news, India has just reached 2.1. They are now officially at replacement rate. So the assumption is that China and India were going to, you know, 40% of the planet's population, were going to power forward. They're just not there. You go looking around the country, and everywhere except for sub-Saharan Africa, or you look around the world, and everywhere except for sub-Saharan Africa, you see nothing but stable below replacement fertility rates in the developed world, and fertility rates in the developed world, and fertility rates that are just crashing in the developing world.
So, are there things happening in sub-Saharan Africa? And if you look at the fertility rates there, they're, you know, over five. I think for the whole continent, it's over five, isn't it?
I don't know what the continental number is, because there are countries that have very high fertility rates, like Nigeria, Niger, Mali. They're around five, but again, look, you know, they were seven or eight, in the 1970s. We went to Kenya to look at Kenya. Kenya is, a classic sub-Saharan African country. Well, Kenya is urbanizing quickly. The government has put in place policies that mandate education for girls. So they have what American equivalent of grade 8. Once you reach grade 8, you have graduation exams. There are as many girls now as boys who sit those exams in Kenya. And by the way, the average test scores for the girls are higher than they are for the boys. So Kenya's fertility rate has gone from 5 to about to 3.7 is the latest data coming out of there. So their numbers are going down fast. If Africa, I mean, you know, if you're in a place of poverty and civil war where government can't really exercise any kind of control, those societies are going to continue to have high birth rates. There's nothing for it. But you have a lot of other African societies that are not in that shape, that are urbanizing, that are getting education to girls, and that are seeing their fertility rates fall. So, you know, Africa is still the worst situation in the world, but the situation in Africa is actually getting better.
All right, so those rates are indeed changing over time. It's really interesting to go look at the rates and the little squiggles on the charts that show where they've been going in the last 30 to 60 years. It's just one of many bits of data that enter into John Ibbotson and Daryl Bricker's book, Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline. We'll talk about what things happen to societies where the population is shrinking and has already in Japan, for example. We'll talk about that example and others. When we come back to the Jefferson Exchange, you can join the conversation by phone and email 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. Welcome back to the Jefferson Exchange with John Ibbotson and you in a minute 25. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. We are talking about the world's population in this hour of the Jefferson Exchange, viewed through the lens of a book by Daryl Bricker and John Ibbotson called Empty Planet, The Shock of Global Population Decline, in which they support the case that some demographers have made that by the middle of this century, we're talking about peaking in human population at around 9 billion, and then a retreat. We begin to actually get smaller in population over time, which has advantages environmentally, but not so much economically, as John Ibbotson has already talked about. He is our guest. He's a writer for the Globe and Mail in Toronto. And you can join the conversation on the exchange at 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. I was just looking at a chart from the World Bank, John, of India's birth rate. You were talking about the fact that it's getting down near 2.1, which is the replacement rate. 2.33 is what it shows, which is remarkable considering it was close to 6 around 1965 or 70 or so. So that's a real dive. When a population is big, though, as the Earth's population is now, it seems like not much variation in the rate can make a huge difference over time.
The way the numbers for Italy, for India, which you have and we have in the book, are wrong, I'm happy to say. Huh. The Lancet, the British scientific magazine, has a huge study that came out in November, too late for the book, unfortunately, funded by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, that takes a much more sophisticated look, we think, at birth rates than the United Nations does, and they have India down to 2.1. They have India having reached replacement rate. Mm-hmm. But in terms of the changes, what happens when you get to replacement rate is not immediate decline, because you still have large numbers of young people who are growing up, and they're going to have kids. So you get one large cohort before you actually start to see the numbers go down. So you would have seen fertility rates in Europe, North America, and Eastern Asia, get below replacement rate in sort of the late 1980s. And only now are you seeing absolute population decline because you had to go through one generation. But it is happening. There are 24 countries around the world that are losing people every year. Japan lost 450,000 people just last year. Italy, Spain, the countries of Eastern Europe, Taiwan, Singapore, South Korea, all these places either losing population right now or will start to lose them shortly. And in the next decade, they're likely to be joined by both China and Russia.
So you mentioned Russia as a basket case. Is that what the term you used earlier?
Yeah, there you just have a case. Now, look, Vladimir Putin has actually done a very good job of trying to increase fertility rates from the really dismal levels they were at 15 years ago by increasing supports for families. And these things do help. If you can, you know, parental leave and daycare and direct payments, these things do actually help. But they don't help to get you all the way back up to the 2.1 replacement rate. Nothing has ever succeeded doing that anywhere ever. But Russia is a place that has a below fertility rate, a replacement rate level, and they have no immigration because essentially nobody wants to move there. And as a result, they too are going to start losing population as well. And again, like China, they just don't have the social supports in place to sustain a large elderly population. They don't have the pensions. They don't have the health care. So they're going to be very hard-pressed to provide social stability. Much more likely to have a very restless and unhappy population going forward. Again, a huge benefit to the United States.
How did Sweden push its rate up? We're talking about the European countries in the book, which are we're graying, they're graying, but low birth rates in Europe. But Sweden had some success in pushing its rate up.
They had some success, but the emphasis is on the some. So the Swedes were worried about this this issue even back by the Second World War. And they began to put in place, in fact, much of what is, you know, the much vaunted Nordic social safety net was actually created in order to encourage women parents to have kids. So they put in place the year-long and now more than year-long maternity leave, easy access to daycare, direct payments for children. Canada, by the way, has most of these now as well. And it did the job of stopping what looks to be cratering fertility rates. They didn't get back up to 2.1, though. I think the closest Sweden got was at 1.9. And it was so horrifically expensive that, you know, whenever an economic crisis came along, they would cut the supports and the fertility rate would go back down again. You can go so far to encourage people to have children. So these are the people who want to have children, but they really are financially challenged to have them. And so if the state can step in and help them, then that's good for them. But in the long run, it will never get you back up to a robust population growth level of fertility because we don't have children for the reasons we used to have them. Even up to a couple of generations ago, you had a child because God demanded that you did. Your religion encouraged it. You had a child because your family expected of you. You were supposed to get married and settle down. The state wanted you to grow the population by having lots of children. Now when you have a child anywhere in the developed world, or if you're in the middle class of the developing world, you have a child because you want to fully realize your own potential. The two of you want to experience how it feels to bring another life into the world and to raise that life to adulthood. It is a profound exercise in personal fulfillment, but it only takes one or two kids to make yourself feel quite fulfilled.
So obviously in places like Europe and the United States, for that matter, as we talk about the fact that we've dropped below a replacement rate with the native population, you can think about immigration. Obviously, in both Europe and the United States, all kinds of concerns about brown immigrants. Let me focus on Europe for just a moment, because you say European Muslims will not get to majority status or even close based on what, their birth rates?
Yeah, so one of the things that happens when migrants move to a new country is they adopt the fertility rates of the host country within one generation. So if you look at Belgians of Moroccan origin or Germans of Turkish origin or French of Algerian origin, their fertility rates are about the same as the quote white quote populations in those countries. So you can use immigrants to replace babies you're not having, but you should not expect immigrants to have babies because they don't. They don't have babies any more than the rate of other groups within that society. And by the way, if you look at the numbers in the United States, we were just shocked. This was one of the things that really surprised us. The African-American and Hispanic fertility rates are converging with the white fertility rate in the United States. So, you know, the myth that they're that either African-Americans or Hispanic-Americans or the Latino-Americans are, you know, somehow reproducing at a much higher level than native-born white Americans, that's just not true. The three fertility rates are converging, which is great because it suggests that in the over time and in the main, Latino and African-American women are getting the education that they need to make the choices that they make.
So when you get a situation where society's native birth rate drops and it chooses not to take in immigrants, that's when you get what you got with Japan. Is that essentially what's happened there?
Yeah, I mean, Japan is now 3 decades in economic stagnation. They had their, you know, their big recession in, I think it was 1989, and they're still trying to get out of it. And one of the reasons they're having so much trouble is that they have very low fertility. They accept no immigrants at all, and they have a declining society. They lost 450,000 people in 2018. And the debate in Japan is really interesting. So do we bring in temporary foreign workers to take care of labor shortages? Well, that's fine. You can handle labor shortages that way, but you're not growing the actual population of Japan because they're just temporary. You won't give them Japanese citizenship. Do we count on artificial intelligence? Well, sure, that automation will help. But again, robots don't buy a smart black dress for the office holiday party. And that's the kind of consumption that drives an economy. That's not going to work either. Or do we just accept with grace a world in which we are in decline, in which we need to be less materialistic, we need to consume less, and accept that this is the kind of world we live in? If that's the case, and again, that's part of the very active debate in Japan, that might be the case for all of us. Once we get into a world of global population decline, how will we feel about that world? How will we feel about a world that's always getting smaller and in which there are fewer and fewer people available to consume the goods needed to grow our economy?
So again, I mean, here when we have an economic system based on growth and the population is not growing, we have to consider different ways of doing things.
Yes. Now, we're not prognosticators much in this book. I mean, we have 2 centuries of Malthusians predicting and getting everything wrong. So we try not to predict too much. I talked to one person, sort of outlined this sort of horrible economic scenario going forward of decline, and he kind of shrugged and said, "I don't think so." And I said, "Why not?" He said, "Well, these things have a way of working themselves out." And the truth is, things do have a way of working themselves out. So there's a lot going forward that we can't predict. Who knows? We might end up, this would have to be, you know, 2 or 3 generations from now, but we may end up where people are sick to death of being only kids. They're sick to death of being raised in small families. And couples get together and said, "Let's have lots of kids. Let's have 5 or 6 just to see, you know, let's just fill the street again." That might happen too. That's not going to happen anytime soon. But it might happen down the road. But that's the future we have to start to look at.
So we have some context from listeners I want to share with you. Nobody stayed online here, but Jeff in Medford put out the theory that the Earth could experience some kind of an epidemic that we don't have a cure for. When you think about things like resistance to antibiotics, I mean, there's a concern about new plagues hitting us. So what do you think about either an epidemic or some gigantic environmental catastrophe like all of Bangladesh getting underwater or something due to the warming of the planet?
Well, there are doomsayers who do see that future. Again, we can't. You can't bake that into your analysis because you have no way of knowing. What if we cure cancer? As Daryl said during a recent interview, if we cure cancer, we're wrong because life expectancies will go on and on and on, and the populations of the planet will continue to go up just because there are so many people not dying at an advanced age. Could famine wipe us out? Could environmental catastrophe wipe us out? Possible. The Netflix is making a good buck producing movies on exactly that premise. So far, though, in our history, we've shown a pretty pronounced ability to bounce back. If you look at the Spanish influenza, it was a huge epidemic that laid low you know, huge amounts of the population. I believe the United States lost more people from the post-war influenza epidemic than actually lost in the First World War.
I believe that's
and
right.
Yet the population of the planet continued to grow robustly throughout all of that period. It takes a lot to knock the human race that far back.
It does. We have an email from David who says this is what happens with a high population in a species. Less drive to procreate, more experimentation with same-sex relationships that do not produce offsprings. He says you see this in the animal kingdom too. Did you make any comparisons between humans and other animals?
No, there's absolutely zero scientific credibility to that email. There just isn't. There is absolutely no reason to believe that because we have a high population, we're somehow becoming decadent and homosexual and not having children. I find that just a ludicrous thing to say.
So, John, do you guys make any recommendations? Do you advocate for any particular policies given your adherence to this belief that the population will hit 9 billion and begin to decline mid-century?
There are a couple of things. Obviously, if you're worried about high fertility rates in Africa, and you should be, and parts of the Middle East, and you should be, then the most important form of aid that anyone can give is to improve education, to encourage governments to educate girls. Because you can do anything you want, but once a girl gets an education, then the issue of high fertility rates takes care of itself. And we're talking about places like, yes, you mentioned Bangladesh. Bangladesh is at replacement rate. Malaysia is at replacement rate. Thailand is below replacement rate. Iran is at below replacement rate. So in some of the unlikeliest places, we're seeing fertility declines take place at a really rapid level. And the secret always is the education of young women in urban environments. That, in the developing world, is the most important thing. In the developed world, if you want to encourage people to be born in order to hold on to the population that you've got without having to rely exclusively on immigration, parental leave. Canada gives more than a year of paid parental leave. Support for childcare so that people can afford to put their kids in daycare while they're working, on-site daycare. Even as we do here, direct tax credits. Have a baby and we'll give you a tax credit. That said, Canada does all of those things. And I think they're important and valuable things to do so that women can have as great as possible equality in the workforce. But it's not going to change the fact the United States and Canada have pretty much the same fertility rate.
Empty Planet, John Ibbotson with Daryl Bricker. Thank you so much.